This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Label Clothing Company. They have been a huge supporter of mine for many years now. And anytime you see me wearing a dress shirt or a suit, it is from them. Everything is custom made. And anyone who knows me knows I hate wearing suits and I hate wearing dress shirts. I not only look dapper, but the clothes feel great and wear really well. So anyone in the need of a custom suit, definitely hit them up. You can find them online at label.co. What is up, everybody? Anthony Vasquez here, joined today by none other than event planner extraordinaire Michelle Rego. She is one of the most sought after destination luxury event planners in the world. And today we talk about how she curated that type of clientele, how she started her business from the ground up and really went after that destination luxury market. And no one does it better than Michelle. So without further ado, I bring you my friend, event coordinator and planner, Michelle Rego. What is up, everybody? So awesome to finally get you in here and
Hello.
Do this with you.
So excited to be here.
No, thank you so much. So to drop in a little bit of who you are, super luxury, super high-end destination.
The business, super
that's
luxury.
All the above. Event planner, and you have a niche of catering to very, very wealthy people. Typically, I'm sure those who want privacy and all that goes along with that kind of wealth. But if you would just give us a little intro.
You know, I've been in the business. It's 20 years, mm-hmm. which is incredible to think about. And when I first started, I had more of a volume business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I did 60 to 70 weddings in the first, you know, I had a flower business. And, you know, I realized that I couldn't give my time and attention to each client in the way that I wanted to. And so, you know, each year I figured out how to do fewer weddings and be able to give a greater degree of my attention. Mm. And, you know, with that came a different kind of clientele. Mm. But, you know, everybody has a budget. And, you know, whether you're at the top end of the list or, you know, in the budget, or if more moderate, you know, you could still want privacy. But everybody wants to be taken care of to the best of our ability and for us to make them feel like, you know, they're getting the best service possible.
Well, we know you do it at the high level, so we'll blow you up for yourself there. So, you know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is so many people use the word luxury in today's day and age.
Yeah.
And I think it's as overused as being an entrepreneur.
I agree.
You know, it's like the word when people put a social influencer or celebrity in their Instagram handle. That's who are you influencing, A, and what kind of entrepreneur are you? But luxury is also gets overused. You know, they say we're a luxury brand, or and there's so few in the world true luxury brands, which I'm sure, you know, there's Hermes, there's one, there's not 50 for a reason. It's right. The highest level. So I know you operate in that field, right? So the one thing I feel that entrepreneurs and business owners always get sold short on is the path there.
Right.
Right. So people just see Michelle here now, 20 years later, but they don't look at what the body of work to get to that point where you are right now is.
Right.
Right. So if you could expand on what that was like, number one. And number two, where you are now, was that a vision path you had along the way? Or is it just as the business evolved, you evolved with it and took what came?
Well, so that's a very layered question and a great question. When there was no trajectory for me to get from where I started to where I am. And I think it's pretty incredible for young people coming into the business. You can go to college, you can major in event planning or take courses in it. And that didn't exist. Sure. So, you know, what was an event planner really, you know, and to say you want to become a designer, that was just not available. And so I started out in, you know, I was a waitress. I never bartended, although I think that I would have been a great bartender and made a lot of money. I would have been good behind the bar. The music would have been great. Things would have been hustling and moving at a very fast pace. I worked in off-premise catering. So that's where I really got my start. Well, I'm from Jersey. And the reason I love tent weddings is that's really where I got my start. Mm. And so, you know, I've loaded out more trucks, more field ovens, built kitchens. And with all that experience that I got, you have a deep understanding of what it takes to create a project. And, you know, I had a very strong relationship with my grandparents. They made us wait on them hand and foot and had us feel, you know, that we thought of it, but really we were making their coffee. We were polishing their silver. We were serving their meals. You know, there were, I don't know, I don't even think you use the word anymore, oak tag charts of our chores every day. And I think
I miss oak tag.
Yeah. Oak tag was amazing.
Excel. Oak tag was great.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Nobody used that one. We're aging ourselves.
People are like, what's oak tag? And like Google oak tag. And so essentially, you know, with the way that I was brought up, my passion for entertaining, my understanding that, you know, you had to bring absolute excellence to everything that you did. I couldn't leave the house if my clothes weren't ironed. Back, I got sent.
Military background?
No.
No.
Just Faye Geraldine, my grandmother. Sort of. Like, in a way. With a huge smile and a lot of freckles. And, gotcha. You know, with that, in each job, you know, you, if you wanted to move forward, I didn't come from any pedigree. So for me to win a job or for me to succeed over someone with a name, how do you do it? You do it through customer service.
Sure.
You do it through bringing a fresh perspective and a unique perspective and confidence, you know, your own unique point of view. Otherwise, you know, there's a million people that do what I do. So I agree with you. I think luxury is very overused. You know, some of my, you know, best parties are, you know, black tie and we served a choice of salmon and cheeseburgers. And we had a sommelier. And so that to me is luxury. Mm. But, you know.
Different.
Different.
But luxury.
Luxury.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. We did a wedding, an event, and I'll never forget it. They did a buffet, which call it what it was. It was a buffet, but a really
now
high
stations.
End. Now stations. It was a buffet. But it was one of the most expensive weddings we had ever done. But it was luxury. It was just fried chicken and okra.
Right.
But it was amazing.
Right.
And they brought in a celebrity chef. I mean, it was done in a way, it was casual, but it was a different form of luxury.
Well, I mean, you know, again, I worked in catering. I went to a lot of weddings on, you know, Route 17 in a banquet hall. And I don't know if anybody remembers Flaming Cherry's Jubilee, but they'd come by in the cart and the thing and the pitchers and fire. And, you know, now I like a Gardon with cheese. Still a cart. Same concept. We're just bringing it up a notch.
Yeah.
So
what, as it started out 20 years ago, you're in the event space. What was the initial impetus to start to focus on leveraging up? Obviously, and I know the easiest one people always say is, I want to work less, make more, which is always there.
Right.
You know, doing 70 weddings a year will kill you, you know, slowly.
Yes.
Or fast, depending. But there's no way you can maintain that, I feel like. It'll just drain you. It's too many events. And
well, so a few things. One, which, you know, every time someone asks, I say, you know, when I came to New York, you know, I didn't have, you know, any history with my business. So, you know, you were, let's say you wanted to go to the Plaza or to the Pierre, you know, to get on, you know, the list of recommended people. And it seemed like such a long path to success. So I decided to focus on destination because no one was in the destination marketplace. And, you know, endemically, people who were throwing destination weddings 20 years ago were of means. So it was, and I was in front of what was the destination wave, which was dumb luck. And I was smart enough to recognize it. And so, you know, just in making that choice to go internationally, you know, have a certain clientele that's attracted to doing that.
Sure.
And then, you know, when the economy tanked in 2008, the people that did really well were the top 1%. And, you know, although they got quiet for a period of time, they got tired of not being able to do what they wanted to do. And they really came out of the gate screaming. And it bumped destination again, even higher. Sure. So, you know, they're just a lot of extenuating circumstances and just being wise enough to recognize it.
Yeah, I remember that whole, it was like a stealth wealth movement where people wouldn't book a lavish hotel in the United States. They'd take 50 people over to the south of France, rent a yacht so that they weren't throwing their wealth around in such a public
and
way.
And entertaining comfortably. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, everybody, you know, what happened and then it'll happen again because it's what we do. But, you know, when things, you know, go a certain way, people tend to criminalize the events or entertainment industry and say, you know, how could you do that at this time? And, you know, that's, I think that can be a little unfair sometimes for people. If you're in a position to be able to do it, you know, obviously you should be able to do, you know, what would, but it just had people be quieter about it, which I don't think is a bad thing.
Sure.
And, you know, and then when things loosen up.
Floodgates open. So, you know, I mean, from what you said though, it's interesting when you said blind luck. So I don't believe in blind luck. I think it's where hard work and opportunity, right. It's like that intersection of the two, because I think we're all in life presented with opportunities. It's a matter of, do we have the work ethic to put us in the place where, when the opportunity presents itself, that we can seize it, you know? So yeah.
I think those are two different concepts.
Okay. See, like, I think it almost sells yourself short when you say, oh, it's blind luck because.
Well, I don't know that anyone could have anticipated that, or maybe somebody did somewhere over here said, oh my God, the destination wedding business is about to blow up. I don't know that anybody anticipated that it would have taken the turn that it did. Mm. You know, first it started with celebrity chefs and all the entertaining shows. And then, you know, content. Everybody's looking for content and they turn from chefs to entertainers, you know, and once that happened, that created a different window of opportunity. Mm. But I did see it when it happened, but I never could have anticipated that's what it was going to be. And everyone says they love travel, but I have been a wanderlust since day one. Mm. So it's my mecca to have all those things come together.
Yeah. I mean, I think if somebody.
Beauty and design and food, travel.
You know, I mean, you have to be into travel if you're going to do. At scale destination weddings.
And you have to,
you don't want to hate the airport. You
know? Right. And there are people that do. I mean, I respect that. I have peers that, you know, they have, you know, it's different than after you have children and, you know, you can't imagine, you know, and leaving your kids and going away and being gone. It's not easy. You have to like other cultures, you know, and I think there are some people who flourish being uncomfortable or being outside of their comfort zone. And there are other people it's more challenging for, you know, I love it.
So what was the pivotal moment where you really knew that you were onto something, where you said you had that, like, okay.
It was my first destination wedding that I ever did was on Harbor Island in the Bahamas. Mm,
and great place.
Oh my God. I love Harbor Island. Still.
Yeah.
And I went down for a site inspection and it was in the winter. It was rainy. It was cold. They lost my luggage. And, you know, it was my first, you know, I'm with a mother, with a daughter, and I never got my luggage. I never got my clothes. I wear the same, of course, you know, me. I end up in the winter going down in a pair of white jeans because I always wear winter white. So it was, and I said yes to things that I hadn't done before. You know, can you put a structure in the pool?
Sure.
Why not?
Could lift the pool, float into the air.
And I remember finishing that and I had such an epiphany about that. I couldn't believe this could be a thing. Mm. And, you know, it was love at first sight. And it was like that for me with the events industry as well. I was working at the Hotel Maclo and I did an event. It was somebody had died and it was their memorial service. They did one on LA, one in New York. And it was the theater transformed into a party. And, you know, in walked Alabama, in walked Phoebe Snow, in walked Steven Tyler. And one of the things that was favorite food were dirty water dogs and egg creams. And that's all we served. And I did the flowers and, you know, the sound. I was learning sound, light. And I remember thinking, this is amazing. This is not a florist. This is production and design.
Sure.
And then I had the same epiphany about destination.
And now, as you've done that, what have been some of the obstacles that have faced you from a business standpoint as you've built that brand, you know, as a luxury destination planner?
I think, you know, the biggest obstacle is, you know, you're educating everyone from a client perspective to whoever your creative partners / vendors are, as well as, so you're selling through this idea to everyone, not only unearthing what the client's vision is and what's possible, but identifying who the people are that can help you deliver that project and constantly staying on point with it and constantly coming. Because, you know, somebody will say something and you're like, that's an amazing idea. That's not for this wedding,
sure,
but it's an amazing idea. And so that's the greatest challenge. And that never gets – there's no magic to how you do that. I think you have to be seasoned and confident and a good listener and anticipatory and, you know, all these things, because you're in it. You have to, you know when to talk and know that it's theater for a day and, and you know, some aspects of it,
it's one live run event.
Yeah. You know, if you're buying the fat, you're not putting it on your couch in your living room.
Sure.
It's for tonight. So I just think that's a process that is always complicated and complex, but it's one of the aspects of it that I find the most fascinating.
See, I think it's like event coordination / fire extinguisher simultaneously. Yeah. And a story comes to mind. Ron was in here and he brought up that you had designed this beautiful cake.
Yes.
It was a whale.
Yes.
And it was the first potential cake in the United States to ever need to charter its own jet because it wouldn't fit into the original chartered jet.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, client doesn't want to know how the cake got there.
Yes.
Client just wants to know the cake got there. Maybe the story is funny post-wedding.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, we just upgraded a jet for the cake. But at a certain level, I feel that's why people are bringing you on in a sense, because it's like those are the things that come up where someone who's green to the business, what do you do?
You know,
how do you have the contacts or the network or the wherewithal to take that risk and go, hey, we need a bigger jet right now.
Yeah.
And it's on the runway and the cake has to get here.
I mean, there are so – and I – listen, problem solving is – you know, it's not for the meek of heart. And, you know, the cake story with Ron is one of my favorites because this cake was – I mean, this whale cake was this big.
He says it's 60-something inches.
Yeah, I believe him because he made it. And, you know, and it was, you know, in picking what design, you know, like, note to self, people, the most beautiful whale is the sperm whale in terms of whales that you're going to do with the tail and the big head. That's, you know, Moby Dick. And at first the client wanted it to be red velvet cake. And I was like, it can't be red velvet. You can't cut into the cake and then it's the wrong color. And
I'm thinking as you cut into the whale, it's amazing, right? Blood red. Yeah,
but it really became a huge issue. And it might not have been a jet, but it was definitely a small plane. And, you know, those situations happen all of the time. And you have to, back to what my answer was before about being anticipatory, you have to also hold on to revenue within a budget and have the confidence to know things are going to happen that are outside what anyone would know, and either to be able to know that you've got it covered or to be able to have had a conversation with a client enough so that they're confident enough and you say, okay, it's going to be this and here's a solution. And they say, okay, great.
I mean, I think that's brilliant advice, not just for wedding and event coordinators, but for anyone in business in general, is that, you know, we built out a new studio, we allotted X. Well, X is never what it's going to be. So, you know, you need to have a 25% pad in there.
That's right.
It's like, you know, I just had a kitchen. I'm having a kitchen installed within the next couple of months. And the contractor gave me a quote. And I'm like, how close to budget do you think we're going to be?
Right.
Oh, well, if this, I'm like, so realistically, let's add another 50% onto the kitchen cost construction price. And then we'll probably be somewhere close just so I'm prepared. And he goes, looks at me and goes, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, but at least we had that conversation up front. So now we're not, you know, halfway through with walls ripped out. By the way, it's going to be X amount more.
Right.
And I think a lot of times if you have the foresight to predict these, it makes that landing a lot easier.
Well, I have a client that I've had for a long time. And the first big party that I threw, you know, it was such a big undertaking for me. It was destination. And the phone rang. And he said, okay, now I want to know, do you have enough gas in your tank to get this thing done? And I was like, I'm sorry. Do you have enough staff? What else do you need? And I remember sitting there thinking, wow, that was really brilliant on his part. And I learned something in that moment, which was, you know, he put all his confidence in me, but he needed to know for himself. It's like, now's the moment. And we opened up a certain, you know, I worked with his financial people. We had a certain amount of money. We talked about what in addition we needed. And I've learned that lesson. and taken that with me. And, you know, it's really critical because clients, especially men, don't necessarily think about all those little tiny details until it gets closer. You don't. And that's okay because we each have our roles.
Women are beginning.
They're involved and they're doing all the things. And then, you know, for whatever reason, I've just noticed that all of a sudden, you know, men are like, okay, God in my universe is showing up. What did we decide for that? What do we have? You know, and you know, all of a sudden, you're okay. So you learn that lesson once or twice, and you have to safeguard for that because it's going to happen.
Of course.
And then everybody's really happy.
Mm. Yeah, I think the harder conversation is the substantially harder conversation is why is the cake not there? Not how did the cake get here?
Or where's my whale cake?
Well, and that's not, you're not going to Carvel.
Is that some cake to go missing?
Especially a 6-foot whale cake. It's not like you could be like, yeah, you know, we have a different cake. It's no, that cake.
Yep.
And it's easier to have that conversation of, hey, we just had to switch planes rather than the cake's not here.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, there are conversations that, and that goes both ways. You know, that I've gotten a call before where you book a church 8 months out. And then you arrive that week and a donor gave money and now they're scaffolding up in front of your entire church.
I just did a wedding in Palm Beach and there's a Greek church right outside and the bride called.
You're like, so there was scaffolding.
Scaffolding? Wait. So the bride calls me and she's at their rehearsal on Thursday night and she goes, there's scaffolding everywhere. And the church told her there was some scaffolding.
Yeah.
So what they did was they left a 10-foot wide by 10-foot high cut out in the altar for the bride and groom to stand under.
Amazing.
Everything else was covered with scaffolding from the floors to the 40-foot ceilings, including all the stained glass.
Oh, that was inside.
Oh, it was inside.
Oh, yeah.
This gets better.
Mine was outside.
During the mass. So the bride calls me and I said, you know, she goes, what are we going to do? I said, well, we have two options. Option A, is there another Greek church you can move your mass to? She goes, absolutely not. She goes, there's just nothing else available. I said, okay. She goes, well, what's option B? I'm like, well, there is no option B. We're getting married at option A.
Right.
She goes, well, what are we going to do about the scaffolding? And I said, well, do you want me to tell you what I would tell someone in a frantic state just to calm them down and then have the realistic conversation on Sunday? Or should we just get that shit over with and we'll talk about it right now? So she goes, I need to know what I'm getting myself into. I'm like, scaffolding is going to be in all your pictures.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so we live in New York. What we can do, though, is we can go back to a Greek church and I can take pictures of the two of you in New York at your own
Greek church. That's right.
In essence,
we're shooting with a long lens.
Yeah, it is a crappy situation.
Yeah.
And your pictures are going to be ruined. I'm not going to lie to you, but we can make up for it in some way. So by offering the alternative, you know what? She was okay with it.
Yeah.
And she goes, hey, I'm still going to get a beautiful church and actually mean more to me.
Right. And she got to, you know, have her come to Jesus moment. Well, mine was outside. And of course, I went all the way down the road to find out how much it would take to remove it. I got the quote. No, it was going to be $40,000. And he said, let's do it. And I said, no, we're not. You're going to walk through the front door in 2 seconds. We're not spending $40,000 to take scaffolding down. Yeah. That's insane. Well, but, you know, we've done things where, I don't know, invitations didn't come in time. And, you know, you get on the Google box and, you know, it's flight to London. Call somebody. I said, you get there. You deliver my invitations. I'll put you up for the weekend.
Mm.
Easy.
So, when I think about as you scale up, right, as your volume goes down and you're scaling up, just as a business owner and as an entrepreneur myself, one thing that frightens me with that is, do you ever worry, right, if you're doing 5 weddings a year or 10 weddings a year or 10 social events a year and your average budget is X, if you don't have that pipeline coming in or you have – you know, a down year where let's say if you're only doing 10, you go to 8, now 20% of your operating budget for the year goes down. Do you ever, as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, have that moment of reflection where you're like, okay, does that ever cause some agita per se?
Of course. Yeah. It's so scary. You know, you were, and the irony of it is you work so hard to grow and to achieve certain things, right? And for me, it was, you know, taking it from 60 weddings to 15 events a year.
Sure.
Bah, bah, bah. So, you know, let's say the year's off economically. Let's say the industry changes, which it has. You know, the challenge with this new age, you know, with everyone's access and digital access, it shifted the client's awareness. You know, it used to be that, you know, now everybody has a different set of questions to ask or answer. They know how many more people are in the business. So, you know, you have to put money in the bank make sure you're saving for a rainy day. Mm. Constantly have your eye in innovation, always thinking about, you know, what the balance of, you know, maybe January is not your big month. Maybe you should be developing dinner party business. You know, there, you just, you have to constantly be thinking about ways to keep your revenue stream healthy. And I mean, go to the shrink, go to Shape House,
yep,
get acupuncture and an IV drip and it'll all work out.
I mean, all good things, by the way, you know, but no, it's a real, it's always a fear because when you're at, you know, I always say there's like the Walmart, which is, you know, the bottom of the business. That's always going to be there. You're always going to have that volume at low end, just based on economics. Then there's the middle end, which I feel like is always the worst place to be.
Right.
Because you're chomping at sharing what's there. And then there's I call it high end, right? And then within the high end, you have luxury. And
but the challenge, but the challenge there is, you know, I used to use this analogy, in BMW, you know, you've got the 3 Series, the 5 Series and 7 Series, right?
Yes.
And everybody's like, I want to be a 7 Series. I want to be a 7 Series, you know? And the truth of the matter is your business really should live somewhere in the 5 to 7.
Yes.
Because living in 7 isn't always possible all the time because of market share, or maybe you're really successful and you gotten a lot of press in 1 year. And then also people say, oh, I'm not calling her. She's not attainable.
Mm.
I mean, there's a flip side to every coin.
Yeah.
And so I think somewhere in there is, you know, where you want your business to live. And you have to have, you can't just draw a line and say, I'm only doing these projects. It just, that does not make sense.
Mm. And then another, just because I feel like the events you do are so involved, and I feel, you know, we talked about this a little off cameras, as you get involved in bigger events, you can very fast lose track of what your internal costs to produce these events are.
Right.
So this event may sound, X may sound so sexy in the beginning, and next thing you know, you're flying 12 people over to the south of France and your budget just went through the roof.
Right.
And you've already now pitched the client on, my fee is going to be this flat rate.
Right.
And now you're eating all that because you need to produce the event.
But we don't, you know, when it comes to, you have to protect as much of the cost of producing the event, you know, for your company as you can. So, you know, if we negotiate a certain flat rate, well, we don't include everyone's, like if you hire freelance or producers, that's not included in that fee. So that you can control, because I can't anticipate flights 8 months from now. I have no idea. And so I do my best to protect that revenue so that that's as pure as possible. So if I do negotiate a rate that's maybe less than my normal fee, I'm not diluting it by having all these other things in there that I have no control over.
Which I'm sure you know people who get into that trouble where you've bid on this job, now you need to execute, and you need to execute it the way you're supposed to. You can't cut any corners because you're going to be on air for these clients.
Right.
And the future of your business rests on that. Right. Now you've taken on a job where you're not going to be able to receive the profit margin that you should have.
Right.
And hours can run.
Well, even worse than the profit margin is to not have enough gas in your tank to do the job.
Mm.
So that's the key. It's like nobody remembers, you know, everybody forgets what they've negotiated along the way. But when you go live and all, it's like opening a box of snakes and they all go in 10 different directions. If you don't have enough people to manage what's happening, you're in trouble.
What would you say in your current landscape is the hardest thing of meeting clients' expectations? So especially when you're given that, you know, income net worth wise, you're dealing with people who have that income and they have the revenue to spend and they have the money to spend and the wealth. So there's a level of expectation that needs to be met with every event that you do, which is why they're hiring you, which is why they're paying your fee. What's the biggest hurdle you face in bringing that vision to fruition?
Well, you just have to be in constant communication about what someone's asking for, what's available and what's possible, you know, and I always use this funny line where it's just funny. I'm in a green shirt today. I'll say, I think this is the color green. Do you think this is the color green? And because everybody, you could think you literally are talking about the same thing. Now introduce different cultures, different time zones. and you've ordered something and the box opens and I'll say, what is that? Well, those are your lights. I'm like, those are not my lights. I didn't order those lights. Mine have different bulbs. So, you know, you have to A, you know, be an over communicator, and B, you've got to have the confidence and the nerve to go back to your client and say, here's where we are, and this is what I suggest. And if they really want to go in a direction that you don't agree with, get it in writing.
Mm. And then to follow that up, if you're now, because of the amount of time you spend with people,
right? Yeah.
And, especially as you start to plan out these destination events, you're committing a huge portion of yourself, let's say a year. I can't even imagine the amount of emails and correspondences that go into one of those. How important do you feel it is to say no to somebody versus to say yes to somebody? If it's not the right marriage.
Well, yeah, I think no, even whether it's not taking on a client.
That's exactly, yeah.
Or within the planning process, no is healthy. Mm. Because I don't think that we're paid to say yes. I think that's a misconception. Because you could yes people to death, and next thing you know, you go live and, you know, but why didn't you just say something to me? So, I often will say, you know, here's why this isn't a good idea. And, you know, it just takes practice. But I don't think you shouldn't just say yes for yes sake. That's to me, that's not luxury. That is not luxury. Somebody is not paying you to say yes. They're paying you to tell them what's possible. And for your creativity.
Mm. Do you ever find resistance with that or shock when you tell people? So I'm assuming it took a little while to learn to say no, right? It probably wasn't.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's comes with confidence, with experience, with repetition and doing it.
And you have to do it with compassion and with understanding. And you have to know if somebody's not going to like what you're saying is, you also for yourself, you know, you have to prep yourself and, you know, what are all the ways they might react or be disappointed? But we live in positivity. Mm. You know, it's not, you know, when those things happen, 90% of the time through this whole process, you know, you want people to feel like it's, you know, they've really had this very positive experience. Mm. So when you go to somebody and you say, here's what the challenge is, well, then they're going to say, oh my God. You know,
it's interesting. We get hit with a lot in my primary business, which is obviously photography, right. Is that now people have so much access, what you were saying before, that they come in with unrealistic expectations sometimes. So they'll come in with some comp sheets and say, this is really the look I'm going for. And I'm like, you know, hey, that's great, but you're getting married on the East Coast, sunsets in the West. And they're like, right. I know, but this was shot on the East Coast. I'm like, I know what they did was they took the sunset picture and then Photoshopped it in.
Right.
Which I'm not really personally a big fan of. I'd rather do something real than superimpose it. And the client will go, no, that's impossible. I'm like, no. See, the sun always sets in the West and you're getting married on the East. The sun will not be behind you. It will be on the other side of the city. That is a fact of life. It's never going to change. If it does, shit's gone really we went really haywire, which is possible given currently everything that's going on in the United States, right? And maybe one day the sun will set in the East and see Michelle's faces. Mm. But we've had those kind of things. And for me, at least, it's really important to always be honest with the client. And I may lose certain clients because of that, but it's something that, hey, if I can't deliver on what you're asking for, I want to be upfront about it because it might not be what I do. And I think to other business owners out there, when we get ourselves in trouble can be when you say yes too much. Because if you can't deliver on that yes, now the client now has built that in as part of their expectation. And when you bring them live, you know, in your case live, or for me, when we're producing that product, if we've given them false expectation, now you have a huge issue post.
Right. Huge issue. And so, you know, you do learn. And I think one of the quickest pathways to success with your team is to role play. Mm. If certain things happen or make up scenarios and, you know, work with your team and say, like, how would you problem solve that? You know, it's something that's learned and it does take confidence and, you know, but it's also a very difficult job. And, you know, we all know when we do it, you know, there are certain things you just know aren't possible. Mm. And not because it couldn't happen, you know, a year from Tuesday, if you were at lunch with three girlfriends, that's possible. But, you know, maybe within the confines of 250 people, you know, in a foreign country, if the weather doesn't cooperate, There's a lot of extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, and now you've banked on an outdoor wedding and it's pouring out, and that's just not, sometimes it's just right. not how it goes.
Yeah.
But I think that's a bigger, you know, it's like a juxtaposition to life. Like, you have to roll with those kind of things,
right.
especially in life, and not just in what we do, but in business and in life.
Yeah.
They go hand in hand. And I think how we deal with those types of opportunities. So I like to look at them as opportunities instead of, you know, people look at them and say, oh, it's a mistake or this. I'm like, no, it's an opportunity, because when something arises, you now have the ability to go above and beyond to either correct or improve upon.
That's
and blow
right.
your client out of the water.
And you just made me think of something, which is, you know, one of the magical aspects of hiring a seasoned planning team is their ability to curate the team that produces your wedding.
Of course.
And so every time I do a project, when something goes wrong, I turn to the people who, you know, I'm producing with, and it could come from, you know, the catering person on site. It could come from the rooms director of rooms.
Sure.
I mean, you know, because they have years and years of experience as well. And, you know, that relationship is, it's so critical to put the time in, to know the team you're working with. Mm. People say to me, what if my client doesn't want to send me on a site inspection? I was like, then don't do the job. I couldn't guarantee an outcome if I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And that is as much about, you know, seeing where the sun sets as it is to getting to know that sitting down and having, you know, a glass of wine with a general manager and creating rapport, because that rapport is going to be, you know, their willingness to jump into the foxhole with you.
And I think about, as we're saying, the word no and people are so adverse to it sometimes, but we had an issue come up, it was like 6 months ago, and we're getting ready to start our shoot. And I go to the planner, hey, you know, the chuppah is a Jewish wedding. Chuppah is nowhere near ready. Well, I let the client hire their own dance floor company. And the dance floor company was 7 hours late.
Mm.
They were supposed to be here to load in at 5 a.m. They didn't get here till 12, which now, so now the florist wasn't able to start building the chuppah because the dance floor had to go down under the chuppah because of the room flip. So the chuppah's not going to be ready. So the
right.
client's not going to get any pictures
like,
in front of this.
I get that the boat knows
that. So I said to her, I said, why did you let them do that? And she goes, looked at me like I was crazy. And I was like, you know, you knew how many moving pieces we have in the scale of this wedding, and there's nowhere else to shoot at this venue except the chuppah, which we made perfectly clear to you prior to. So now we have a problem. And the client was like, well, I want pictures in front of the chuppah. Well, the chuppah is not going to be built. And the planner was like, well, you hired a different dance floor company. I'm like, you let them.
Right.
And, you know, you never had that conversation. Hey, if you don't use my people, I have no control over the outcome. And look what happened.
Right.
You know, and I don't know what you should have done. We should have put your foot down. But it's, again, it's like one little thing now. You don't realize it seems so trivial in the beginning phases. Oh, it's just a dance floor.
Yeah.
But now the whole production.
Right.
And it just makes me think in terms of the grander scheme of business, when you don't pay attention to something small like that, it has nothing to do with dance floor or producing a live event. It can be such a cancer in you.
It's the pebble in your shoe.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. And that'll wreck your heel for life. You know, and all of a sudden it's, if you don't have, it's almost like people say, I have an obsessive personality. And I'm like, well, if you don't, it's just part of, you know, and I know you do too. There's that balance, and the balance is out of whack. That's why people keep talking about like work-life balance in life right now. I'm like, I don't know if that really exists, but.
in all the years that I have one friend that has known me a long time, and instead of obsessive, he says, hey, Rigo, what's hot and what's not? Because I'm like, I've listened to Lizzo 72 times in the past 3 days.
Because you're in the zone.
What's hot and what's not.
It's important. So you mentioned before younger people in the industry, and I know you've done a lot of educating on the platform of how to become an industry, you know, important in the industry, how to elevate your business. What do you think the biggest hurdle facing people joining our industry now is comparatively to what we faced 25 years ago?
Well, I love educating because, number one, I learn so much about what's going on and how things are changing. Listen, I would say 20 years ago, you could fail massively and pick yourself up yep. and put it back together. And it wasn't on such a public platform. Mm. And I feel terrible for young people struggling to learn in the same way that we all did. And, you know, it's just, it's a megaphone in this culture. Mm. And, you know, you really have to keep your nose down and watch, because if things, you know, spin out of control, it's just scary. Mm. And, you know, I am so grateful that there was no cell phone when I was in high school.
Could you imagine?
I can't. I can't. And so that to me is, it's just, and the instantaneousness mm. of, I love the digital space so much. I've often compared it to, you know, I was chatty and a note writer in school. I was getting caught writing notes. You know, for me, social media is very much a continuation of that.
Sure.
Ooh, it's like, but you know, on the other side of it, it's, you know, this instantaneous culture is a lot of pressure on young people, and it moves so quickly. So it's beautiful and hard at the same time. Mm.
It's interesting. You know, I think that like what you said is, I have a client who was very public, and she made a tweet when she was 16. And 10 years went by and someone found that tweet. Could you imagine? And someone said to me, can you believe what she said? And I said, let me ask you a question.
She was 16.
If you were 16 and you had a phone and you had Twitter, no. would you have said something potentially even worse? And they looked at me and go, no, not me. I'm like, are you kidding me? No. I'm like, if we all had phones at 16, come on. I'm like, you're giving a kid no. access to the world at their fingertips. Mm-hmm. Of course they're going to say stupid things. We're adults and we say
Geraldine
stupid things.
Faye Geraldine was my, she kept me under lock and key. What was the word she used to use? Are you being, I have to think of the word. It's going to come back in a second. But I, you know, you just, you know, it's challenging because there's also, you see everything done. Mm. And I get, you know, I didn't go to college for this career. So I learned by doing.
Of course.
And that's right. But I spend a lot of time learning. And so I think it must be very difficult to see it all there, and all the resources are there, but you don't, it's sort of like the difference between cooking and baking. You know, I don't know that everybody knows how to put it together initially. And then it's, you're on that epic fail scale, scale, fail, whatever that is.
And there's levels, you know, and there's, you have to like be willing to work up the levels.
Yeah. No, and I think people are willing to work up. I just don't think it was as public.
Of course.
And I think I think that would be hard.
And I think it also in a certain way, like people don't understand what it takes to produce an event or to, you know, and I'm into cars, all these different things. People just don't get, you know, that you see a finished car on Instagram now, totally accessible.
Okay, what was your car in high school? What was your car in high school?
Me, I was a Mustang guy up until a few years ago.
That's a good car. You know, got given a car, which I was happy to have.
I mean, it was $1,000 Mustang, let me preface by that.
Okay, well, mine was a Duster with a 3-speed on it.
Nice. There you go, Michelle. That's what...
And it, there was...
I knew I liked you.
My sister, I think somebody, you know, it scratched by something in the back quarter panel to be pulled out, and my grandfather put drilled holes in the side, but never fixed it. So it looked like it had like bullet
holes
on the side. Yeah. And I loved that car. It was fast.
It was a cool car.
Right.
American ingenuity.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, what do you think the hardest, the most difficult part now about our new clients? Because, you know, as we go from millennials to Gen Zers, their buying habits, you know, I call it the age of Amazon, where everything is instantaneous. Mm. You can go online and I can order anything I want. It's going to be delivered to my house potentially by the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Or if not, I can talk to it something and it's going to make sure it's there tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that carry over to a certain degree in what we do. And people sometimes don't understand. Like I had a client go, I don't understand why the images cost more money. Well, I had to retouch every one of them. Well, doesn't that take 5 seconds? I'm like, well, unfortunately, we don't use that app on your iPhone. We're actually, there's a value in that. and there's labor. And I think in some ways, you know, you're faced with a consumer who's much more knowledgeable now, and in some ways, not always, there I say, you know, not always the most knowledgeable because they don't understand that specific art or that specific platform. But for people in this industry that are now selling to Gen Zers or millennials, where would you guide them?
Well, I think again, I go back to this. When we sell our company, I'm selling how we produce parties and how we produce destination events and my specific approach, which is what guarantees the outcome and the success for the project. So whether it's so in the uniqueness of, let's say, a Gen Z, it still comes back to, you know, it takes 6 weeks to get a proper tent bid back. I don't understand why it takes that. It's a fact.
I'm floored by that.
Could take 2 months.
Really?
A proper tent bid with a build out of a floor.
Sure.
And, you know, submitting permits.
AC or heat if you need, all that.
Okay. HVAC, all of it.
Gotcha. 2 months.
But it's managing those expectations for instantaneous. And, you know, it's very, and always having them feel that you're giving them that full attention and they're not being sidelined, but that in, but if we put it forward, it's been thought about and it's, you know, and I can stand behind it. So, the same is, you know, when you're building out a budget or when you're putting vendors forward, you know, it's the time it takes to reach out to a vendor to see who's available, to review their current body of work, to know, you know, how do they, have they traveled, you know, do they do destination? Do I know someone who's traveled with them before? Mm. How is it like to travel with that person? Mm. That's a whole different animal.
You know, I did a
wedding. You could be in Midtown. You've got one personality. You land in a foreign country and all of a sudden I'm like, hi, who are you?
I'll never forget. I did a wedding in South America, maybe like 05. And my second photographer was with me and she's like, I'm not feeling so well. I'm like,
yeah.
What do you mean?
Yep.
She goes, I'm really far from home. I'm like, yeah, 8,000 miles. What did you think we were going? We're in the south of Argentina.
Here, look, here it is on the screen.
Yeah, I go, boy, 5 miles on that one. I'm like, we are, yeah, that is, you are speaking truth right now. I want to go home, she says. I'm like, okay.
I had that happen.
The wedding ends tomorrow at 1 a.m. At 1:01 a.m., you're going to hand me those memory cards and you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, your ticket's been paid for to return on Thursday. It's going to cost you a fortune to fly home tomorrow internationally if you can get a flight, but by all means. She goes, I've just never been this far from home.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, I wish, again, my fault, because I always believe that any mistake that happens within my company is my fault.
Right.
Just my own philosophical understanding of I should have asked the question, how do you travel? Do you have an issue going to South America? Have you ever been farther? So now it's, again, you know, you don't really get to know someone like what you just said until you're far from home.
Until you travel
because
with
them. Because the person at home and the person on the other side of the ocean, depending which one it is a different human being.
It's a different human being.
And it's my personal assistant now who basically goes everywhere in the world with me. When I hired her, one of the first, I said, how do you travel? She's really well.
Yeah.
I'm like, where have you been? She's like, all over the world.
Yeah.
I'm like, flight's delayed. You're sleeping on an airport floor. Who am I with? We're together. Do I like you? Yes, we like each other. I'm good.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. Like, it's about who you're with. And
again, it comes back to, you know, curating the team and knowing not only who travels well, but, you know, plays well with others. And at the critical moments that you're not going to have one person who's part of your creative team who all of a sudden the universe revolves around that one person. Because that's just that's the pebble in the shoe.
Yep. Isn't it amazing how one apple spoils the bunch? So one rotten apple spoils that bunch. Because now that person is such an attention suck, but there's still a job that needs to be done.
Well, exactly. And again, it's not to talk about, you know, I mean, you know, stories of negativity. It's that experience has taught me that it matters who you pick and who fits together. It's like anything, you know, certain, you know, if it, and to know that when the pressure is on, that those people are going to continue to perform. It's like being a good tennis player. You know, when the reason people go and you go to Arthur Ashe Stadium and you're out of your mind when someone's just played for how many hours and how hot it is and they throw it out for a win, in your mind, you're like, that's insane.
Yeah.
That's a champion.
Yeah.
And so there's a true difference to me about people. I'm like, there's a ton of talented people.
Mm.
A ton.
But
you just need to know. No. You just need to know who that, how that, that group fits together. That's key. And performs.
Yeah. I mean, it's so important because it's at the end of the day, we're talking about accountability. You know, I would, in your position, no one wants to know, well, this happened because of that person. It's Michelle, why did this happen? And it's on you now.
Right.
Whether your team made that error or there was an issue. And, you know, I think back, I was doing a shoot in Florida and all the overhead was taken. So I had about $100,000 in cameras on it. So the flight attendant said, you know, sir, you can't come on with your, I'm like, I can't check it. There's like all my camera equipment. She goes, well, sir, the overheads are full. I'm like, look, here's $200 cash. Offer the guy in the first row so I can swap my bag and I'll pay for his ticket down. Sir, I'm not doing that. I said, all right, ma'am, you're going to make this as complicated as possible, but I got you on this one. I said, is there any regulations about how many cameras you can strap to your body to get on an airplane?
Oh my God.
And she goes, no, sir, there's not. So I walk on the plane. I have four camera bodies and lenses in my pockets.
Yes.
And I go to sit down and she goes, sir, what are you doing? I said, I got to take, here's my bag. You can now bring it downstairs. My client doesn't want to know why my camera got broken or stolen by the guys at JFK in the terminal when they scan it and see $100,000. I need to get there.
I would have videotaped
I got two free round trip tickets from JetBlue. anywhere in the world. It was actually worked out good. But I took pictures of myself and I texted them to the clients and it was hysterical. After the job was over, it was like, anything for the job. And they were like, what happened? And I'm like, you know.
It's amazing.
But no one cares. You know, at the end of the day, all they care about is that, was the job done? Was it done correctly? Was it done on time? And was it done with a smile on your face? If I would have told them, hey, they took my bags. By the way, my cameras are in New York. I can't shoot tomorrow. Well, that's just totally unacceptable. No one cares. You know, I always say no one cares. Make it happen. And there's always a way sometimes, and I know with what you do, especially with dealing with different cultures, you just have to approach things differently.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's also, it's also what's fascinating to me about it. Because if you're striving for perfection, which no one's ever going to reach, but you're reaching for the, somewhat out of the quote I heard yesterday, you know, reach for the stars and hopefully you'll touch the mountaintop.
Reach for the moon. If you fall short, you'll land amongst the stars, maybe.
No, close. Yeah, close. Mine's, yeah. They're both wrong.
Okay.
Same idea. And the, you know, the challenge is that, you know, you, now I got off, now it's like, now I'm obsessing that I remember the quote.
Okay. Did you get it?
No. I'd have to Google it. But, you know, the challenge is that, you know, when things go wrong and on every project, things happen and you have to, that's even part of talking to your client. There's no way to anticipate all the things that are going to occur because we're relying on the sea of humanity to help us get it done, you know, and everybody's going to behave in a different way, but that they understand your commitment to delivering the body of work. And sometimes, you know, when things go wrong, I'm so fascinated by what happened and you step back and you think, okay, could not have anticipated that. And then you sit back with your team, you know, going back to what we said earlier, and problem solving, and then coming up with the new direction and what the possibilities are. That's, to me, that keeps you in it.
And I think that's the way, you know, again, like what we were
you
saying.
You can't do this. Yeah. You know, you got to, you think, oh, okay.
Opportunities, you know, there's opportunity and crisis, I always say, are the same symbol in Chinese language for a reason. It's because
I didn't know that.
Every crisis presents itself an opportunity. You know, there's a great book, which I talk about all the time. It's called Extreme Ownership. It's written by ex-Navy SEALs, and they're obviously playing at the highest level, far above what we do, because every decision they make results in life or death. It's that black and white. And ultimately, the leaders who are making those calls, the decisions they make will decide whether a father goes home to his child or to his wife. And, you know, they're playing, again, life at the highest level. But the concept of it is that the leader is responsible no matter what. If his team made a mistake, it's because he didn't prepare his team enough.
Yeah.
If they didn't pivot the right way, it's because – again, there's countless, but the concept is that the training and the team was so well put together that when something goes wrong and someone might die,
Right.
But even upon that death, that the pivot was made to save the other six lives.
Yeah.
And then so to learn intense. And go back and debrief. Yeah, super intense mm-hmm. at the highest level. But the book made a really big impact on me because it basically says, take ownership. It's the easiest way. So yeah. One of my men died. No, it's my fault. I sent them out there.
Yeah.
Well, something goes wrong at an event. It's my fault. I didn't ask that question about, do you travel well? Or.
And I believe that, you know, we're also, you have to, something's always going to happen. You know, there's just, and you learn on every job, you know, it's putting your finger in the dike, you know, no matter how much experience you have, you know, there's a handful of things you can't anticipate. So, you know, going back to sort of stringing together all the questions that you've asked, it's, you know, taking your historical knowledge, your experience, putting together a great team, you know, having a good relationship with your client and having cultivated the relationship with your creative partners to be able to go and say, the caca just hit the fan. And now I really need you to help me problem solve and to be able to kick in a creative solution that I don't see, you know? And so you're working it from every angle. And to me, that's a true win. You know, when you finish a project and, you know, it's exciting.
Yeah. And I think the adversity brings teams closer together.
Oh, you know, it's very much so.
By far. The best moments that are celebrated are always the biggest obstacles that were overcome.
That's right.
So I want to be completely respectful of your time, which you've been so generous to give
I'm
us.
So thrilled
please.
So thrilled to be here.
You've been so generous to do this, and I know you have a dinner to make, and I want to make sure you get there. But before I let you leave, I'm going to ask you one last question.
Yes.
If you, looking back on your life, your business, everything you've incurred from today to 10 to 15 years ago, if there's one piece of advice or one conversation you could have with the younger Michelle to the older Michelle, that would be catastrophic in the sense of it would revolutionize how your business was, or it would change in such something so dramatically, what would that be?
Well, I've worked really hard in the last 4 or 5 years at self-care and balance. And that touches on every category. And I think, you know, when you're striving to build a business and you're, you know, working so hard to create something, you know, it's sort of at any expense in your time. It's like whatever it takes, whatever it takes, whatever it takes. But, you know, if you put the right support system around yourself, mentors, both people who have been successful, failed, succeeded, failed again, and that you have a vocabulary within yourself to know that everything's going to turn out. There's always a solution. And to be able to step back and know that in repose is where we create and come up with new ideas. And I think, you know, it's just, I don't come from that support system. So, you know, I never felt the permission to, I don't know, feel like, you know, if you just step back and think, you know, I just did.
Yes.
And so, you know, you learn as, you know, if you can reflect and see what history tells you. And you see what you've done more wisely. Mm. And, you know, people say, God, you just, you know, you've done this for so many, you seem relaxed. You seem good. I was like, I take good care of myself now. Mm. And I didn't as much. So I think that's critical.
I think that's well said. Words to the wise. We could all do that. Yeah. I know that I've suffered from the same disease, you know, and I don't want to say disease, but I think at a certain point.
But I think it's a curse of being an entrepreneur because you can't, if you're not pushing and striving, and how do you achieve that? You know, you know, even, you know, talking to a friend, it's like, we were talking the other day, you know, you can't take your foot off the gas.
just not, and you know, it's even at the highest. And again, like I would say, you know, and not that I'm Elon Musk and, you know, wouldn't make the comparison, but the guy sleeps on the floor of his factory for a reason.
Yeah.
And he actually crowdsourced, I don't know if you saw that, but they GoFundMe me a sofa bed for him. So he could sleep on a sofa bed while he was finishing a project 6 months ago, because he kept taking pictures of himself sleeping on the floor because he was literally living in his factory. But if you want to operate at that high of a level, whether you're Elon Musk or any entrepreneur, whatever your goal is, whether you want to be the best pizza maker in the world, it comes with a price. And often, unfortunately, that price is our sometimes health. We put our health aside. We don't take care of ourselves, whether it's going to the gym enough or even simply sitting down and doing something like this.
Right.
Because we're so busy.
Right.
Which has been, I think, the greatest blessing of this podcast for me is I get to have great conversations with people in a focused setting like yourself.
Well, and that's been part of my, I mean, I have been putting myself out there in ways that I wasn't as comfortable in the past, you know, doing podcasts, meeting people in new ways, you know, saying yes to more things, but things that align with my brand, not just saying yes to everything.
Yeah.
Saying yes to the right things.
And on that note, is a perfect way to end. You're awesome.
Thank you.
And I love that I got to sit down with you finally and do this.
So me too.
I want to thank you.
Thank you for your, the generosity of your time.
No, please. Thank you for your time. And let everyone know where they can keep up with you and check out all the cool stuff you do.
All right. Thank you.
Where do we find you? No, we'll put it in the show notes. But yeah, like, please.
Sorry. I was like, I got lost. I was going to say happy holidays.
Yeah, a little bad. Yeah. Well, more importantly, where do we find
you? So Michelle Rego, destinations.com, or Michelle Rego on Instagram.
Cool.
And really, those two platforms.
P.S. You do weddings in New York or social events anywhere,
right?
I know it says destinations, but
you for that. What an excellent question. Yeah, we work a lot.
In the United States. Does it even have to be a destination?
U.S., internationally. Really, I think people know me for the wedding business because I launched it after 9/11 and there was no corporate.
Yes.
So I really built it on weddings.
But if someone wants to throw a 1,000-person gala in New York City, you can handle that.
Dinner for 50 people.
Cool. Call her. You know where to find her now. We love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's great.
Hey, everybody. Doing this has been an absolute journey and an amazing time. I have learned so much, and I want to thank you all for listening in. If you kindly would, we would just ask you for your support. If you've liked the show, if you've gained anything from it, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or any of the other platforms where you are viewing this. We would greatly appreciate it, and it means the world.